This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You know, we don't get to do it often, but we do it sometimes. Talk a little bit about sports, and we'll ultimately get to that. But joining us is a little bit of baseball royalty, the grandson of Tito Francona, the son of Terry Francona. Nick Francona, United States Marine Corps, joins us. Nick, welcome to All Marine Radio.
Thanks, Mac. I appreciate it.
What's it like to be, you know what, I saw your grandfather play. I don't want to date myself, but I saw your grandfather play. And what's it like growing up in for those of you who don't know, Nick's dad is the manager of the Cleveland Indians right now, and they just punched their ticket to the playoffs, so congratulations on that. And grew up in and there's some families that are steeped in baseball history. The Francona family is one of them. What was it like to grow up with a grandfather and a father, both involved in Major League Baseball?
It was definitely a cool experience. I was pretty fortunate to be able to, as a kid who loved baseball, to be able to go to the parks. When I was a lot of my better memories are actually from when my dad was working his way up as a coach through the minor league system. It's a lot more accessible, not quite the same as a big league environment. So I would be able to go to the park with him every day. Some of my favorite times are actually in the he managed Michael Jordan in Birmingham in the White Sox system. We spent a few months. He was managing winter ball in Santiago in the Dominican Republic. I went down there for a couple months, and that was a phenomenal experience. So it was a pretty cool childhood, getting to go to the ballpark every day and follow him around. And a lot of his big league managing time came after I was a little older, when he was in when I was in high school, and then I was in college when he went to the Red Sox.
You know, it's funny, because I would have Nick and I lived the same life, and I would have the minor leagues are fun. There's not as much pressure, there's not as much media, and you get to hang out with your dad, and the players are younger and kind of more fun. But then you say my dad managed Licey in the Dominican. We hated Santiago. In fact, I started a fight in a game against Santiago. Yeah, you'll love this. We're there for Christmas. I was in college, and we go down there, and Licey's beating Santiago, I don't know, 8-2. Somebody comes up, hits a grand slam. Santiago goes up 9-8, and my dad goes out to change pitchers. And now they sell hard liquor in the stadium, right? So guys walk around with buckets with chunks of ice, and they sell Ron Rico, right? Rum, and it's a fairly festive environment. So my dad's walking off the field, and the guy walked down to the dugout, and he threw a drink on my dad, right? And I'm sitting there, and I'm behind the plate, right, where family sat, and there's a chain, like, that comes down to the area. There's a chain and an usher stand there. And I watch, and I'm waiting for them to kick this dude out, and they don't kick him out. So now I'm pissed, right? And this guy's putting on a big show, screaming and yelling. So he kind of gets in an aisle that's between the lower seats and the upper seats that, you know, runs around most stadiums. And he's walking towards where I'm sitting with my mom and three sisters. And and he's putting on his big show. So I stand up, I step over the chain, and I walk towards him. My mom grabs my wrist. And she says, "Michael, where are you going?" I said, and I snatched my wrist, "Let me go." I think I scared my mom a little bit. And so I walked up to him, and I said, "Why'd you throw that drink on my dad?" And he looks at me and goes, "Oh, you mana mata son?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And with that, he turned like he was walking away. And he's like, I'm 20. He's probably 40. And then he spins and he throws a punch, right? I duck. The punch goes off the top of my head. The glance is off the top of my head. And I'm in my flip-flops and shorts, right? So I step forward and I punch him right in the Adam's apple. Boom. And he steps back. And then I'm calmly stepping out of my flip-flops because all they want to do is kill him, right? And all of a sudden somebody grabs me and I'm flying backwards. I can see guys who pinched hit and our driver jumping down into this fight that's broken out. And I throw an elbow to get away and my elbow hits a rifle. And I wasn't affiliated with the Marine Corps yet, but I hit that. I was like, whoa. I turn around and here's this National Guard dude grabs me and he looks at me and he says, Alto. I said, all right. All right, yeah. So I don't have good memories of San Diego, Nick. Just so you know. But you know what? But it was fun. They had the best beer in the world down in the Dominican Republic, El Presidente.
Presidente.
Oh, yeah. It's the best. But yeah, and then you get to the big leagues, and it's not so fun. It's not everybody tells the truth. People may not know this in sports. Not everybody tells the truth. Not everybody's above board. And the things you grew up getting raised on all of a sudden change, and it's certainly not as much fun. But your dad, your dad does what my dad failed to do in 1986 was win the World Series for the Red Sox for the first time ever. That must have been crazy, huh?
Yeah, I was a freshman at Penn that was his first year there. So that fall was, that was the 2004 season. He'd been in baseball a long time, and I think might have been the playoffs once, or hadn't been as a coach or manager. So my parents were letting me go to the games and when I could, and I ended up missing a ton of school that fall. And, it was kind of a quick and fast introduction to how passionate and at times crazy Red Sox fans can be. And that they were, when they were down 3-0 to the Yankees, we're sitting there like thinking he's going to get fired after one season there. And then 2 weeks later, you're royalty in Boston. It was pretty wild.
We experienced the other way, which is, oh my God. Two outs, nobody on in the bottom of the ninth in Shea Stadium. And I always say this, if you ever have something like that, something like biblical in nature happen to you, you really don't want it to happen in New York City. Okay. Kansas City, Minnesota, Milwaukee, Denver, nice, you know, Midwestern kind of people. New York City, it like sucked on top of sucked. It was awful. And then worse in New York City though was Boston. And the way they dealt with it. And, you know, look, everybody knows now that Roger Clemens is a liar and a cheater, okay? People didn't know it then. And so, you know, my dad takes him out of the game when he says, hey, I'm out of gas, I've got a blister, and I've got the start of a cold. You need to bring in Calvin Schiraldi. And so my dad gets hung in effigy in Boston for taking Roger Clemens out. But do you think Clemens would come out and say, hey, that's not really on him? I was running out of gas, and I told him that, and told him, you know, he needed to bring somebody else in. He didn't say shit, right? And you got guys like Peter Gammons writing stories about, you know, McNamara blows the World Series. McNamara blows the World Series. And then Gammons starts this Knife the Mac watch on in the old, and there was no internet, in Sports Illustrated every week.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, Knife the Mac. And it's just, it was horrible. And people wonder why I hate the city of Boston and the state of Massachusetts. When I was on active duty, I used to say, my fondest hope is that New Hampshire invades Massachusetts, Civil War breaks out, Marine Corps gets sent to quell the disturbance, I get made the military governor of Massachusetts, and I paid the son of a bitch and give it to Connecticut to park their boats for the winter. And I normally only reserve that little piece of that little gift for obviously lieutenants who were from and other Marines that were from Massachusetts, otherwise known as massholes. So anyway, yep. Not that I'm still jaded by it, mind you, but I might be. So you grew up like that. So what points you towards the Marine Corps, Nick?
You know, it was, I really didn't have much exposure to the military growing up. It was, I'd say that the family history of service was probably less than distinguished. It was, my grandpa was of the era of the draft, post Korean War. And he was, like a lot of guys I found out in baseball, he was, drafted and would play on a couple Army baseball teams here and there, but nothing really to speak of. Right. I remember he passed away this spring, but a couple of years ago I was asking him about so what'd you do in the Army? Was your MOS? And, he had no idea, which was pretty funny.
You know, my dad did the same thing. He played, but you know what? The inter-service baseball teams and championships, those all were, you know, those games got played by professional baseball players.
I think they had a couple leagues, and one of them, I think the one in Hawaii, like, they had some legit players on those.
Right. It was not like they were big time players. When they showed up and reported in, and people found that out, like, yeah, I know you're a great, like, my dad would train, he was an infantryman, so he would train with his unit, and then when the truck came out to deliver chow, he went back with it, and then went to baseball practice, and then tended bar in the Oak Club at night, and played on the base baseball team at Fort Lewis, Washington. That's what I did during the war, son. So, connection to the Marine Corps either.
No, it was actually crazy. I had a buddy that I played travel ball with growing up, who I went to a prep school. He went to the public school, and we were friends from baseball, but like not like that close of friends. So it was kind of interesting even to me that it had such an effect on me. He had enlisted in the Marine Corps after high school, was a grunt. And, my freshman year, when Iraq, 2004, so Iraq had been going on for a little less than a year, and it really bothered me to no end. It was keeping me up at night that, like, I'm sitting there in college and having a pretty cushy life and no concerns in the world, and he's over in Iraq. And that stuck with me a lot, and I went to the recruiting station. And mind you, at this point, I was completely ignorant to, like, anything and everything. I had, like, really didn't quite do my homework, and I don't think I could have named, like, all the services, for example. I had no clue the difference between, like what an officer was, what enlisted was. I walk in, and the recruiters certainly aren't going to explain that to you at that point. They're just like, yeah, like, take your ass out, like,
sure, no problem. Come on in. What? So who's
Have at him. So I was like,
who's recruiting station?
Who's
recruiting station do you go in?
It was in Bucks County, at like one of those like strip mall kind of ones where they had like a couple different ones, and I think it was the Navy one. And ignorant me, it's in there being like, oh well, like, sure, they'll certainly explain to me all the options, and I can figure this out. Like, certainly not the case. And so my friend ultimately had a bit of an intervention. My plan was to just sign up and then tell my parents after the fact, because I figured they would not be pleased about me leaving kind of in the middle of the year.
Right.
And so my friend talked me out of it and said, like, told me to hold my horses a bit, and I could do it after if I wanted to. And it ended up, I kind of had that urge still and knew I really didn't know what I was getting into, and it was, I knew that there was a lot of uncertainty there, but I also knew it was something I was going to regret if I didn't do it. And I think having that bit of uncertainty was like, I just knew that I didn't want to, like, be looking back on life and say, like, I wish I had done that then.
All right. So you go in and, you collect your information. Then what happens? This is going, you know what, this has all the ingredients of a great story, by the way.
So after I graduate, I go, like, I didn't do ROTC or anything, so I go to OCS. It was kind of funny because I think my parents, like, weren't, like, thrilled about the idea of the Marine Corps at first, and I think that was, like, we didn't really know much about it. And they kind of had this, like, perception of like, oh, it's a bunch of dumb grunts and that kind of thing. And like, once you go join the Air Force or
Why didn't you join the smart guys? Like we've seen it. Like, really? Why? Come on, yeah. Are you kidding me?
And I'm pretty sure my mom had this idea that, like, she really wasn't, like, you know, you hear from, like, a lot of parents, like, they're worried when their kids are going into the military. My mom was, like, pretty convinced I was going to be back after, like, 2 weeks from OCS, so I don't think she was all that concerned. And I ended up, she wasn't really worried until it came time for MOS selection. She was a little put off with, she had this idea that, like, I finished relatively high where I was going to probably get my choice. And she was, lobbying for me hard to be a comptroller or an adjutant. And I'm like, Mom, I don't know what to tell you. She was like really going hard at this of, God, you studied business. This would be like a great, great use of your degree and all this. I'm like, Mom, I don't know what to tell you, but like nobody watches like a Marine commercial. I was like, man, I would love to do their payroll.
Yeah, I'd so want to be a disperser.
Mm-hmm.
That is. Hold on, I don't know where. Are you still there?
They definitely shifted their view on it. I mean, I think once they met a lot of my friends at TBS, like I had some. I think they were really impressed with like the quality of peers. One of my best friends from OCS, he was a guy who he had enlisted in college and took a year break to go from VMI to go to Iraq. And proved the old adage correct. You don't bring bridge around your sister. I brought him home for a long weekend. He ended up marrying my middle sister.
What? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Your family got, you know, my dad, he like, tell me you haven't signed a contract. I'm like, I haven't signed a contract. Don't sign one until we talk. And I said, hey, Dad, you don't have a vote in this, just so you know. He said, well, which branch of the service are you talking to? I said, the Marine Corps. He goes, oh, shit. Those idiots can't pour piss out of a boot. I said, oh, really? Just because you were an Army dude and they suck? Is that where we're going to go with this? And he said, you got to be kidding me. I sent you to college and blah, blah, blah. I said, all right. Anything else to add to the discussion before we say goodbye? I called my mom and she said, I think you'll love it. I think you'll be great at it. I was like, there you go, my girl. Enough said, boom.
That's awesome.
That's all I needed. But
yeah,
but then yeah, when they came around it and it was intoxicating, right? The way we do things in the Marine Corps, you know, your parents get around it and they're like, this is awesome. This is squared away. This is good. So funny.
Yeah, I think they definitely have that, like, coming to like the when you commission after OCS and then they have a family weekend at TBS and they meet your friends and kind of get the vibe for the first time and like obviously I think like as most parents you have that like sense of pride and the Marine Corps is very good at cultivating that and then also just like this feeling that they're gonna take care of you and I think that's something the Marine Corps does really well.
Okay, so now it comes to MOS time. Your mom's lobbying hard for the disperser route, and then what happens?
I was really torn between infantry and ground intelligence. And ground intel is it's relatively new. I mean, it's been around for a decent amount of time now. But it's like the hybrid between, I think it's part of the Grand rifle plan, is try to integrate intelligence and infantry a little bit. And I ended up going that route and it was, it's kind of funny. They sell you on it at TBS. Like it's one of the more popular MOS choices where everyone thinks they're going to be a scout sniper, platoon commander or go to a recon battalion. And like at the time, like you're naive enough where you're not sitting there thinking like, what the hell does like recon have use for new second lieutenants that really have like no idea what they're doing. And so I think, I got super lucky in that, I ended up having a sniper platoon from the day I checked into 3-4 to the day I left. But most of my, I think a couple guys in my class ended up getting a little bit of time with the platoon. I think the vast majority of them, they ended up being, end up with some job at division or regiment staff, and that's a little bit of a misleading MLS choice.
The so you go do that and you report to 3-4 when?
Sometime early 2010.
Early 2010, and do you do their next deployment to Afghanistan?
Yeah, they had just got back from deployment to Afghanistan, like right when I was checking in. So I did the full cycle workup with them,
right.
And I'm sure I'll give you a funny, embarrassing story from that. So when you know when you're going through like TBS and all the there's a decent amount of runway before you actually like, get in front of your platoon, and then they build that moment up like it's like talking to your Marines for the first time, like that's like the kind of like the end of that first stage, and everything's geared towards that. So like it's a little like you're a little nervous when you're doing that for the first time. And the these guys are like, I mean, like haven't even been on terminal leave yet, have been back like a couple days, and so they're like more or less like mentally checked out. So I'm meeting my guys, talk to them, keep it pretty brief because it was a Friday and ready to cut them out on leave. And I'm talking to them, give them a little spill, talk to the meet them individually afterwards, and a couple of them are hanging around and introducing ourselves. And one of my guy ended up being one of my team leaders, might be one of the best Marines I had, is Sergeant Jack, Alex Jack, and Alex is looks pretty like big built guy, looks very Polynesian, and he introduced himself, and he's like, I'm Alex, I'm from, we're telling each other where we're from, and he goes, I'm from Micronesia, and so I'm like, okay, like, is that a, like, that's cute, are you guys messing with, like, the new lieutenants? I know that's just, like, a made-up place from, I've seen the movie Zoolander, I know it's not even a real place, and the guys are, like, staring at me like a blank face, and they're like, sir, like, didn't officers, like, I thought you, like, officers had to go to college, like, didn't you go to, like, an Ivy League school? And we're sitting there, they're convincing me it's a real place. I'm like, oh my god, it was so embarrassing. But they gave me help for that for quite a while, but it was pretty fun.
And you're like an intel guy. You're supposed to be smart.
Yeah, that was a pretty funny first day there.
It is. So when you do step in front of, you're like, you know, you're hearing the same voice in your. Well, I don't even say that. And it's like, this is like my whole career is built to this point. It's going to be awesome. And then it's not really as great as you think it is. They're looking at you with trepidation going, please God, let this guy be relatively normal and not a goofball.
And it's tough with snipers because that's a,
you're not
like you get,
it's not novices, right?
Oh no. And I mean, you get some like salty, wise ass Marines there. And I thought it was like an outstanding leadership challenge in that, like it really like caused me to like raise my game a little bit. And that they, you learn pretty quickly, like you're not, they're not going to be like, they're going to be professional Marines. They're not going to be like nearly as deferential. They're not like, they don't give a shit that you're like a second lieutenant. That's not going to
come. Your wow factor is not so high. And again, you know, these are second, if you look in the way the Marine Corps is laid out, you have units that, you know, new joins go to, right, and the rank and file come and mm-hmm. go from. And then you have secondary units that draw from those frontline units and gets to pick in onesies, not even twosies, in onesies, yeah, we'll take him. We'll take him. Then you get to test into the unit, and if you don't test in and if you don't fit, then you go back. So, you know, so when you, as a novice officer, show up, there's not a whole lot of, there's no wow factor, right? I mean, honestly, the biggest thing going on is this guy a dick? Is he going to be able to do this? Is he going to be grown up enough to treat us with respect, to learn from us? Because he's a novice, And we're not. And we're pretty skilled at what we do, which is why we're here. So it is. It's not a small leadership challenge for somebody who's still learning their job and going to go do it.
Yeah, and I mean, they've, like you mentioned, they've, on average, have probably done 2 to 3 deployments already, have gone through the sniper screener to just to get in the sniper platoon. So they've earned their spot there, and you've got to prove yourself a little bit and prove that you can like belong and add value. And it's a lot more collaborative, I'd say, of a leadership dynamic. It's not that was probably actually one of the things that worked out pretty well is I had some pretty solid NCOs, and that's one thing that could have gone kind of like either way, where like the guys checking out could have kind of been like the assault dog that poisoned the platoon a little bit.
Right.
But
let me ask you this.
They were great.
You grew up like, you know, we grew up the same way. The one thing I knew how to do, I knew how to be on a team, I knew how to hang out, and I knew I had leadership qualities. And so wherever I've gone in my life, right, I find that group, and I know what to do. It's the easiest thing I do in my life is to be part of a team, because I've done it since I was a little kid. I was raised around it. And so that part to me, the assimilation and being part of that, was always easy, and I think always opened other doors for me as a leader. I'm curious, even when I was a young leader, you know, and here's the question I would get asked, which I still to this day is one of my great honors throughout my career. Hey, sir, by enlisted guys, are you prior enlisted? My answer, no, I'm just cool as fuck. And they go,
That's funny.
No. But talk about that. I mean, being on a team, it's what you know.
Yeah, and that's, I think there's a lot of similarities and lessons you can learn from, like, spending time in a baseball clubhouse. And one of the things about baseball I can't speak to other sports with the same level of knowledge, but you're playing every day. You spend so much time throughout the year together. And I mean, even since I was a kid, the clubhouse has changed a little bit now, where guys are kind of in and out of the clubhouse. It's not as much like hanging out there. But it's if you're not authentic and honest, like that gets exposed pretty quickly.
Right.
Like you had brought up the example of guys like being able to kind of hide that dynamic and put on a different public face. Like the guys in the locker room know the score, and you'll get exposed to the fraud very quickly if you're not walking the walk.
Yeah.
And that's so that puts like it puts a premium on certain leadership qualities of like being like one of the you don't do the, which is very percentage of the I told you so because I can style of leadership is certainly not going to fly. And being like transparent and authentic and just be like being yourself, and you don't have to have all the answers. That was something that really served me well.
Give me a Terry Francona leadership piece that you've always carried with you. I'll give you a John McNamara piece. When you handle yourself, use your head. When you handle others, use your heart. And number two is, it takes no talent to hustle. Anybody can do it. You just have to want to. So those are two that I've always kind of carried with me. Give me a Terry Francona leadership piece of advice that you've taken with you.
You know what? He's never been one for like the leadership maxims.
Right.
I've actually never really heard him spout those off too much. But one of I think the thing that he's really, one of his strengths is treating people with honesty and respect, like everyone on the team, from the clubbies to the star players to the bench guys that might play once a week. And I'll give you a quick story here. One of the things that I wouldn't use these words to phrase it at the time, but it was kind of like the idea of like keeping the mission in mind.
Right.
And when that first year in Boston, they had some like a fairly eclectic mix of players. From you had Manny Ramirez, a bit of a space cadet, Johnny Damon, Schilling, Pedro. Like it was a fairly wild group to say the least.
Right.
And that was not that smooth of a year at all. I mean, they had some ups and downs, and mid-year they weren't like playing too well, and it was like somewhat in doubt whether they'd even make the playoffs. And that was when they had the big trade with Nomar mid-season, there were some interesting dynamics where guys were doing a little bit like own program type of thing, and with Manny every now and then that would rear its ugly head, and it was wearing on some of the other players, and it was a tough thing to balance because at the time, I mean, this guy might be the best right-handed hitter in baseball, and when Manny was engaged, like he was unbelievably good.
Oh man,
I mean, he was
crazy.
He would take the best at bat he'd see, and he would also do some stuff that would just blow your mind. And some of the other guys would come in and complain about it and say like, hey, what are we going to do about Manny? And like, it would wear on other guys,
right.
Other players. Mm-hmm. And, my dad tried to balance out with him. He said, look, I'm not going to tell you that this is like okay or that I like it. That kind of stuff, but like our job's not to like have the most like white bread Boy Scout team that we can. Like we want to like our job's to win the World Series. And we all know that we are better with him than without him. And like he might be an idiot, but he's our idiot. And like let's like pull it to the end of the rope and same end of the rope here and get the most that we can out of him and try to win this because like we could be like the most we can like kind of like die on the principles of we could sit here and be like really rigid about things and not accomplish what we set out to accomplish. And at the end of the day, keeping that in mind, it was a tough thing for him because that doesn't sound like very clean and pure. Like he definitely felt like he was prostituting his values a little bit,
right.
But it was that idea of like, it's not even so much of like, we're paid to win. It's like, we want to win. That's what we're here for.
You know what? And again, people know, you just know the stories that got into the public, right? So there's a whole nother series. Like I say this about Bill Clinton, right? Bill Clinton and his friends get together and they laugh like, God, you know, the public went crazy over Monica Lewinsky. Can you imagine if they found out about, you know, right? That's what you don't know, right? So the American public has an opinion about Manny Ramirez, and when we talk about him hitting, we're not talking about him hitting the number 3 and 4 pitcher on somebody's staff in the playoffs. We're talking about him doing it against the number 1 and 2 on a consistent basis in clutch situations that year.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an exaggeration.
Unbelievable.
He's probably the top. Like when he was at his peak, he's top 10 right-handed hitter in the history of the game.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And you combine him with David Ortiz, it was crazy. But there's a whole nother series of stories that you don't know anything about. Okay. that stay in the clubhouse, that the players know about, that irritate people, and you live together, you know, for 8.5, 9 months out of the year sometimes if you're going to the playoffs, and that stuff wears on people, and they get tired of it. And so to keep the peace is no small task. And so interesting.
Yeah, well, and I think that's like one of the kind of the core jobs of the manager a lot of times, and especially nowadays, it gets kind of trumped up as like one of the soft skills, and I think people have put a little too much emphasis on the game strategy, and that's what gets debated in the papers and on talk radio.
Right.
But it's not a small thing by any stretch to keep guys like focused on what you're there for every day. And it's not like giving the Vince Lombardi motivational speech. It's a lot more subtle than that in most cases. But it's no small task. It's one of the more important, if not the most important one that you do.
I used to tell, you know, my sisters would ask me, we'd be sitting watching a game, which we did literally thousands of times growing up as kids. And they'd say, what's Dad going to do? And I said, well, this guy's going to pitch it, and this guy's going to come in to pitch. And then they would ask, like, how do you know? And it's like, well, if you know who's hurt and you know who kind of matches up against who, the moves are not very difficult, right? And they would look at me, yeah. And they would like, okay, Mr. Baseball. I said, no, it's not hard. The harder skill is, right, as Nick said, is keeping guys living together for 9 months from killing each other and playing together towards a purpose. And that's, in my opinion, I mean, look, the accountants are trying to take over baseball. Okay. And so there are at some point, you know, you're going to have another version of Connie Mack back down there wearing a suit, right, with a scorecard rolled up, like making moves, because they think they can do it. And then they're going to find out, like, oh, that team thing. Yeah, I guess that is important.
You know what's funny about that is, like, you've seen that shift happen pretty publicly already. And it's amazing to me how divisive it is even amongst the fan bases.
Right.
And it's, like, you see, front offices won't come right out and say this, and the manager are certainly going to not neuter themselves and acknowledge this. How much influence the front office has on things like the lineup, and they're sending lineup cards down, that type of stuff.
Right.
But the there's one of the fascinating things I observed is that there's a certain paradox where it's not the guys that are the managers that are the best at math, that are the most like analytically inclined, that actually can implement some of the more analytical strategies effectively. It's the ones that actually like engage about it and require and are not going to be like refuse to just be puppets for the front office. They actually have a lot more success in implementing them because the kind of approach and what my dad's approach is like, I'll listen to like anything that you guys tell us, like starts with kind of from this position of trust of I'm going to just explain to me what you want to do. Because like if you want me to implement this, like I need to like genuinely understand it, because otherwise I'm going to be undermining my own authority with the players and my own credibility by just parroting what you are saying.
Right. Well, it happened in Philadelphia earlier this year when the left fielder said, "Yeah, I'm not playing today," and he's like he's in fuego, right? He's on fire, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm not playing today," and they're like, "Why?" And he said, "The computer said I shouldn't play." Right, and then
and that's what's funny is like people look at that and they look at like the soundbite, but like you, your head probably went to the same place as mine on this, and it's like that's a failure of like the previous like days, weeks, like months during spring training of communicating with that guy, and like if for somebody to like come out and say that, there's a lot more under the surface that's not being said.
Well, let me tell you, I'll just tell you what's interesting about the whole analytics baseball and whatnot is the people in Los Angeles are still rip shit about last year's World Series. They lost, this is their view, we gave the World Series away based on analytics. That the math was more important than what was going on the field. And the Houston manager figured it out. And he got asked in a press conference about, well, so-and-so, you know, his third time through the lineup and blah, 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 blah. And I think his answer was this. Yeah, you know, I get the analytics piece of it, okay? But I also have a set of eyeballs, okay? And my job is to balance those two pieces. When somebody is that dominant, I think you take into account the analytics, but they have to play a diminished role because of how dominant he is tonight. And you certainly might shorten the leash for a pitcher, but good God, did you see what he was doing? And the Dodgers didn't do that. It's like this guy's throwing a no hitter, then a one hitter, and then boom, he's out of the game and they lose. Like, what just happened? So it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's where, like, that's something I've seen a lot where people, and I think they convince themselves, I would argue delude themselves into thinking that it's being uber disciplined to gain that very small edge in every circumstance. And what happens is that actually creates blind spots where you're not agile enough and mentally flexible enough to react and respond to events that are unfolding in front of you. Like the situation you just described is a really good one.
Well, you know, and it sounds like a decision that you're going to ask a leader to make in combat, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a great quote, there's a book that's an author that's pretty popular among these are best-selling books and he's pretty popular in baseball, the analytics trend. You've seen Nicholas Taleb, who wrote Black Swan and Anti-Fragile, and his latest one's called Skin in the Game. They're really good books. And this is a guy who's he actually went to Penn as well, and was a trader on Wall Street, like very advanced degrees in math, like one of the more like brilliant quantitative minds out there. But like one of his big things is like talking about the limitations of it and when to apply things and what's academic versus successful in the real world. And that informed kind of my thinking on baseball analytics a lot. And one of my favorite quotes from his book is he says, more data, such as paying attention to the eye colors of the people around you when crossing the street, can make you miss the big truck.
No, it's interesting, and it consumes baseball. It's very, you know, and again, it has its place, and it's not insignificant. And baseball was far, in my opinion, far behind the times, because I used to do a thing as a kid. I would subtract home runs. So-and-so's got 15 home runs, and or let's say they have 23 home runs and 65 runs batted in. And I would subtract home runs from runs batted in and said, okay, this is what he's driven in the rest of the times. That's not very good. Right? So that was my own little white trash version of analytics about what makes you good and what makes you doesn't. What makes you and what doesn't make you good. And so I think baseball had a long way to go to catch up with meaningful statistics. Statistics that matter. And then I think it's working its way through the system. My guess this morning. Hold on, Nick. Let me just reset this. My guess this morning, Nick Francona, former officer in the Marine Corps, son of Terry Francona, professional baseball guy. Nick himself involved in professional baseball. And we're going to talk about that here in a few seconds. Okay, go ahead. Make your point. I cut you off.
No, yeah. One of the, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, with the, you see analytics like being such a derisive term among fan bases sometimes, and it gets it's funny following it because you get people who some of the younger fans who will be like treat everyone like they're like the old man yelling at a cloud if you're not buying into it, and the other group saying talking about how people are ruining baseball, and I think there's one of the fascinating things with it is there's been a ton of hubris that's come with analytics. Like every latest trend is the end all be all to baseball knowledge. And if you look at you don't have to go that far back to look at where there's some of these analytical innovations are really like the diametric opposite of the analytical trend 10 years ago. Look at like those good Red Sox teams, those were built around mashing the ball. And now we can measure defense more quantitatively, so we can see that you might be able to hit 220 and be a really valuable player. Andrelton Simmons out near where you are with the Angels, is a guy who's finally hitting, but like he doesn't need to hit to be a stud. Catcher framing. People forever were talking about how that was like the way a guy receives the ball. Like that would have been openly dismissed by analytics folks is like, oh, that's like an old school intangible, like doesn't really matter. And now that's like the sexiest thing they can find.
Crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Nick, let's go back to your career. We could talk about baseball all day. Back to your career. So when do you go to Afghanistan?
Spring of 2011. I think it was, I was on the advanced party. Sometime in March.
So we're in Afghanistan together. You guys go up near what, Musa Kale?
No, we were, you know, I think that was the AO we were supposed to go to during the workup. We're planning on that. And then we ended up going to, Nari Siraj, who's just south of, Sangin. It's probably 2/3 of the way up from, between Lashkar Gah and Sangin. And wasn't a lot of, obviously the whole area is rural, but this was, there wasn't really like a district center or anything there. Like a village was probably defined as a cluster of 7 or 8 compounds. It was, there wasn't a lot of coin going on in that area.
So you guys go there. We're battle buddies then, man. I was down in the Marge of, I was in the vicinity of Marge with RCT1.
Wow.
So you go there and what are you doing and how does the deployment go?
It was an interesting deployment. I want to say it was 3/8 that we fell in on, and we had they had come off of a Mew. And it was a weird area because it was kind of between those like more built up areas in Lashkar Gah and Sangin, and had been cleared originally, and one of the and by the Brits, and one of our company commanders, this guy, I think it's Major Terrell now, was one of the best officers to serve with. He had actually been an exchange officer with the Brits and had participated in that, which is pretty fascinating. And it turned out to be like really valuable to us to have his experience there. And that area had been, I don't want to say neglected, but we just didn't have the footprint to really do much in there. So when guys when there was that focus on the larger battles that people talk about, of like the Marja and Sangin right before we got there, that kind of flushed a lot of people out into these areas, and it was primarily it wasn't abandoned by Afghans because every irrigable inch of land was poppy fields, and there were a good amount of land for that there, right along the river. So it was a pretty valuable piece of property for them, and they certainly weren't going to give that up. But it was pretty fascinating. And you got there in March, and so had a little bit of time, maybe 6 weeks or so before the poppy harvest was over. And it was dead quiet when you get there. Like people are finding like an IED here or there, and some pot shots, and it almost, and you know that going in, of like the cyclical nature of the fight, but it's pretty interesting to live it, where you go from like pretty calm deployment to like that poppy harvest is over and all hell breaks loose.
Give me a leadership lesson If I said, hey, Nick, you're going to talk to the lieutenants today, a group of them from wherever, or a group of non-commissioned officers, give me one lesson from your experiences fighting in Afghanistan that you would give to junior leaders.
I would say that trust your training. The Marine Corps, and this is something I did not appreciate enough at the time. It's probably hard to appreciate. I mean, you were in a lot longer than I was and had a lot broader experience, so you could probably see this while you're still going through it. But the Marine Corps does a really good job of preparing you. And so, like, have some faith in that, but at the same time, like the things that you hear all the time, like good ideas come from everywhere, like keep an open mind and apply some critical thinking. And that, like, the nature of conflict now and combat is so complex and so dynamic that, like, you're there for a reason, like, you're in charge of your platoon for a reason. Don't keep a closed mind and don't be, like, too by the book, and that, like, you might have to make it up as you go a little bit and be creative. And at the end of the day, if, like, the Marine Corps does an outstanding job of you know what the right thing is. You're going to be tactically proficient. Like do the right thing and execute, and 99% of the time it's going to work out.
Interesting. And what you're talking about is be the leader. Right? You don't have to be the smartest guy. You don't have to have all the solutions. Be the leader and make it an ensemble effort. And if you do that, things normally work out for the good. Interesting. You know what?
Just don't sit back and observe. Like take the initiative piece, which like you hear a thousand times. That's probably something that like you have your light bulb moment the first time you're over there where you're like, man, like this is why, because that really does matter.
You know what, Nick? We're not even going to get to talking about baseball, so we're going to do another segment next week. So this is going to take us probably about 2 or 3 weeks to get through, which is fine with me. I want to finish up with your career, but before we do, I want to ask you this: the Red Sox are so good this year. Okay, do you think the gods of baseball, that govern baseball, do you think the gods are going to allow them to do an impersonation of Secretariat and go wire to wire? Or at some point will they say, I'm sorry, you're too good, something, you know, you're going to get swept in the first round. Because they are off the hook good. And I have friends that are Red Sox fans who are terrified that the latter is going to happen. And I told them, I said, when they come back from 6 runs down in the ninth inning, that's too good, they're going to get swept in the first round. And their reaction was, I know, it's going to happen. Are the baseball gods going to allow the Red Sox to go wire to wire?
It's funny you say that about the Red Sox fans spreading. I'll give you a quick story. In 2004, when they were down to the Yankees and then came back, and in that seventh game, they had a huge lead. And it was as comfortable as a playoff game gets, which it is obviously, like, relatively speaking, in Yankee Stadium, you always, like, the old Yankee Stadium, you'd always have that vibe of, like, something is going to go horribly wrong here.
That place.
And they're, it was basically like a ceremonial position after the restructuring where you had the commissioner, but you had the presidents of the, American League and National League, and it was kind of like an honorary position. I think it was, Gene Autry's widow, was the president of the American League. And it's like the eighth inning, and they have a pretty substantial lead at the time. I want to say it was like 10-3, something like that. And they're wheeling in they're lining the locker room with the plastic sheeting for the celebration afterwards, and they're wheeling in the trophy, and Jack Yachter's in there, and they're talking about how they have to get it set up for the post-game celebration, the broadcast, and you can see, like, I'm sitting there watching it in my dad's office in the clubhouse with some of the front office guys. It was Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer and Josh Burns and a couple other guys, and you can see Theo getting a little bit agitated as they're setting this up, particularly in light of the experience the previous year. And they're bringing it in. He's trying to get him to tone it down a bit and relax and just wait till afterwards. And they explained to him, like, oh, it's like you guys are up a lot and you only have like 4 outs left. And he's like, you must not be very familiar with our franchise's history.
That's the truth. It's the truth.
Yeah. But they're like the team this year, I haven't followed them quite as closely as like on a day to day basis, but they're a juggernaut. It's so hard to, one of the things that's different about baseball is and this is a cool thing that analytics have shown in comparing the sports, is that there is a factor where like the most dominant team isn't going to win a playoff series necessarily. Like that's like even the best odds are going to be something like 65-70%, and that's like on an enormous mismatch. So that's what's pretty, it was frustrating about baseball, and it's what's beautiful about it at the same time. So I think like, and just like compare that to like the Warriors when they were at the height of their kind of run in basketball, like there's essentially like zero chance that the eighth seed is going to beat them in the first round of a playoff series. I mean, they're just steamrolling people. In baseball, like you're not going to, like even the best teams, you're not going to go, you're unlikely to go through a series of 3 blowouts or 4 blowouts. And it's, you know, it's tough because you're also in the playoffs. The other thing is, like, you might be the better team, like, 1 to 25 on your roster, but it gets a little bit different when you isolate it with like, you're facing these teams ace. You might face them more than once. That, like, you see, the best example I can think of that is, remember in 2003, the Marlins. When, like, the Marlins were not the best team by any stretch going into that playoffs. And Josh Beckett just put it in another gear and carried them.
Yeah. Annihilated teams. It was like you're watching going, holy smokes.
And you see that every year there's somebody that will do that. Madison Bumgarner's had a couple of those postseasons.
Yep.
That'll happen every now and then.
Verlander last year. And so.
Yep.
Crazy. So, all right, you never really answered the question. Do you think the baseball?
Yeah, so I would say.
But you're invested though. You're. It's not like you don't have a dog in this fight. So I don't know if it's a fair question to ask.
Yeah, you know what? I like start to finish. I think they're like on paper definitely a better team than the than Cleveland. But it's hard to count Cleveland out. I mean, like Corey Kluber can be that guy on any given day. Got some dynamic position players, Lindor and Jose Ramirez might be the most underrated player in all of baseball.
That is incredible.
Baseball's in a, as much as you hear the people complain about the state of baseball right now, there's some really fun players to watch.
Oh my God. I don't think I've ever seen more good young players in baseball in my life. When you watch the players that play now, they are absolutely phenomenal athletes, and they do things I don't know that I've ever seen. And I'm like Nick. I've been around baseball since I was zero.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's just they're incredible, stronger athletes than have ever played baseball across the board, but just incredible athletes. So I love watching
look at the, like the AL playoffs. I mean, you're gonna see like Ramirez, Lindor. You're going to see Correa, Altuve, and hell, half that team is rising stars in the league. Betts and Bogarts on the Red Sox, and I mean, there's some like really dynamic superstar players out there that are. It's going to be interesting to see who. It's really a matter of like who kind of steps up and carries the day during those games.
All right. Let's go back to your career. So you deploy with 3-4. Do you stay in the Marine Corps? Do you stay out?
So I ended up getting out. They had a program where I forget what it was called, but this is like in the Marine Corps, awesome personnel management where you could get out a couple months early if you were not deploying again. And they were going back and forth. There was like huge ebb and flows of like make the Marine Corps bigger, then make it right. small and right. make it big. I had a couple of my guys who at one point for the enlisted Marines, if you had the 8541 or 0317, had graduated the Scout Sniper Basic course, they were getting some pretty legit bonuses to stay in. And so there were guys that were getting bonuses to stay in, and before that enlistment was done, we're getting bonuses to get out early on the same one. It was pretty unbelievable.
That's crazy. All right, so
I had we wrapped up our deployment and it came back, and I was leaning towards getting out, but was pretty sure I was going to get out, and then we had not been back long at all. And they had I think they called them like the hot bill billets for they needed somebody ASAP. And there's only two, of the ground intelligence officers in a battalion, and they needed one from our battalion to go to Afghan National Army training program, which, like, as you know, is not that's one of those ones where you're like, shit, this is not going to end well.
Right.
And I said the other lieutenant that had that MOS had just gotten married, so I said I'll do it. Don't make him do this, but I really didn't want to have to stay in for 5 years.
Right.
I said, like, I'll do this, but I want to get out when I get back. And so we're sort of working our way through that one. And I remember my mom was pissed because she was like not having it. And I was like ready to go back like a couple weeks after I got back to 29 bombs. And then they ended up putting a hold on those types of deployments for a bit because I was like right at the height of the green on green shootings. So ended up we had a couple months in 29 bombs and we were back, which was a bunch of the officers were like four or five of us, and we rented a house out there and had zero furniture. We were all like getting out at some point in the next like 4 to 5 months. The only thing we had in our house is that we ordered like this Olympic quality ping pong table. And it was like our dining room table, play some very competitive ping pong, had quite a bit of beer pong on there. And we'd have like WWF folding chairs and like a sunflower seed bucket as like our stools, a couple camp stools. Like it was pretty ghetto. One of my team leaders came to, we had to go take some of the guns up to our Marines that were training at the Mountain Technical Course in Bridgeport. So I had to drive up there with him. So he comes to pick me up and comes to our door and looks in the place and is like, man, like, I didn't think officers lived this way. It was hilarious.
Aren't you supposed to be different? The
Yeah.
All right, let me ask you one more question. What and we'll pick up after you leave, but have you already had set your mind that you want to get into professional baseball when you're done with the Marine Corps at that point?
Kind of. I had, it had always been something I'd wanted to do.
Right.
I hadn't, I wasn't like dead set on it. But it was something I wanted to do. And, it was a matter of trying to like navigate and figure out what that would look like. And I when I got back, I had, I definitely had the conversations. I talked to some of the GMs that I knew. And it was it was interesting in that, like, I think, there really hadn't been people, like, by that point, like, we'd been at war for a decent amount of, about a decade. So you'd have the cycles of guys getting out and there'd been a decent number of those transition programs that were companies that were like actively recruiting guys. But baseball really hadn't had any of that. And so the sort of option at that point getting out was you can, and this was like getting like hooked up kind of option, was you can go basically be like an intern and like cut up some video in the minor leagues or go do something else. And I felt like that would have been a pretty tough transition. To go like make minimum wage after the Marine Corps and more so is not even so much the pay as much as the like responsibility and like being challenged. So I ended up actually going to Booz Allen in DC and working on a couple really cool projects there. And about a year and a half later, I still had that itch to work in a front office, and I knew it was going to be like I was going to have to bite the bullet and take a big pay cut and start at the bottom. So I figured it'd be harder the longer I waited. So decided to make that jump then.
All right. So we'll stop there. And then next week, when you come back, we'll go ahead and pick it up there. And, you know, let me just tell you what Nick has written and been interviewed, and been critical of Major League Baseball, their hiring practice, the way they deal with Memorial Day. And so that's what we're going to get to. But today I wanted to introduce him, talk about his career and I think Nick certainly has grown up with the tag Terry Francona's son, but I think after listening to him for an hour, you understand it a little bit more than that. And so, and certainly with his own opinions and own views, and I'm certainly sympathetic to that. One of the reasons I joined the Marine Corps was, I'd been Johnny McNamara's son my whole life, and I still am, and I'm proud of that. But I wanted to be a leader, but I wanted to lead, my own thing. and kind of step away out of that. And so I think when you have a dad that's pretty successful and prominent, I don't want to say you struggle with that, but it's always a part of your life. And you learn to make, I don't want to say peace with it because you were never at war with it. But, you know, you grew up with somebody like that. You want to achieve and you want to do it on your own and things like that. So, Nick, obviously.
That's certainly something I can relate to. You want to make your own way and not, I think people will walk through and assume that there's the advantages to that and there are, but like, I don't know, I think the way you said it really well, like the way you're wired is you don't want to, you want to prove yourself. And the Marine Corps is a good place to do that.
Yeah, it's an awesome place to do that. All right, Nick, I'll give you a call and we'll set up next week. And the first of a series of installments that we're going to do and really going to kind of turn a spotlight on the hiring practices of professional sports leagues. You know, everybody says they love veterans. Anybody hiring them? Anybody, I mean, like those leagues do operations, they do logistics, they do administration. That sounds like anybody you know of? Oh, shit, that sounds like us. Are we hard workers? Are we not afraid to roll up our sleeves and get things done? Absolutely. So we're going to talk about that. And we'll start with baseball. And Nick's been gracious enough to come on. All right, Devil Dog, first of all, have a good week. And I will give you a call, and we'll set up next week.
Sounds good. Simplify next.
All right, bud. There you have it. Nick Francona. Former 1st Lieutenant, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines.
In Afghanistan.
Don't touch that dial. We're going to, where was that audio coming from? We're going to take a break. And when we come back, the man, the myth, the legend himself, Michael Musselman, will join us on a busy Tuesday. So, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.